Chapter 77. He looked full at her in return, with what she thought was severity. He felt that it was not a moment in which he must let himself be tender, and flinched from implying a hard opinion. I mean, there are many thoughts and habits that may help us to bear inevitable sorrow. Multitudes have to bear it. She turned her brow to the window again, and said impatiently, You must tell me then what to think, and what to do, else why did you not let me go on doing as I liked and not minding? If I had gone on gambling I might have won again, and I might have got not to care for anything else. You would not let me do that. Why shouldn't I do as I like, and not mind? Other people do. Poor Gwendolyn's speech expressed nothing very clearly except her irritation. I don't believe you would ever get not to mind, said Deronda, with deep-toned decision. If it were true, that baseness and cruelty made an escape from pain, what difference would that make to people who can't be quite base or cruel? Idiots escape some pain, but you can't be an idiot. Some may do wrong to another without remorse. But suppose one does feel remorse? I believe you could never lead an injurious life. All reckless lives are injurious, pestilential without feeling remorse. Deronda's unconscious fervor had gathered as he went on. He was uttering thoughts which he had used for himself in moments of painful meditation. Then tell me what better I can do, said Gwendolyn, insistently. Many things. Look on other lives besides your own. See what their troubles are, and how they are born. Try to care about something in this vast world besides the gratification of small selfish desires. Try to care for what is best in thought and action, something that is good apart from the accidents of your own lot. For an instant or two Gwendolyn was mute. Then, again moving her brow from the glass, she said, You mean that I am selfish and ignorant? He met her fixed look in silence, before he answered firmly, Who will not go on being selfish and ignorant? She did not turn away her glance, or let her eyelids fall, but a change came over her face, that subtle change in nerve and muscle which will sometimes give a childlike expression even to the elderly. It is the subsidence of self-assertion. Shall I lead you back? Said Deronda, gently, turning and offering her his arm again. She took it silently, and in that way they came in sight of Grandcourt, who was walking slowly near their former place. Gwendolyn went up to him and said, I am ready to go now. Mr. Deronda will excuse us to Lady Malinger. Certainly, said Deronda. Lord and Lady Pentreath disappeared some time ago. Grandcourt gave his arm in silent compliance, nodding over his shoulder to Deronda, and Gwendolyn to only half turn to bow and say, Thanks. The husband and wife left the gallery, and paced the corridors in silence. When the door had closed on them in the boudoir, Grandcourt threw himself into a chair and said, with undertoned peremptoriness, Sit down. She, already in the expectation of something unpleasant, had thrown off her burnous with nervous unconsciousness, and immediately obeyed. Turning his eyes toward her, he began, Oblige me in future by not showing whims like a mad woman in a play. What do you mean? Said Gwendolyn. I suppose there is some understanding between you and Deronda about that thing you have on your wrist. If you have anything to say to him, say it. But don't carry on a telegraphing which other people are supposed not to see. It's damnably vulgar. You can know all about the necklace, said Gwendolyn, her angry pride resisting the nightmare of fear. I don't want to know. Keep to yourself whatever you like. Grandcourt paused between each sentence, and in each his speech seemed to become more preternaturally distinct in its inward tones. W what I care to know I shall know without your telling me. Only you will please to behave as becomes my wife, and not make a spectacle of yourself. Do you object to my talking to Mr. Deronda? I don't care two straws about Deronda, or any other conceited hanger-on. You may talk to him as much as you like. He is not going to take my place. You are my wife. and you will either fill your place properly to the world and to me, or you will go to the devil. I never intended anything but to fill my place properly, said Gwendolyn, with bitterest mortification in her soul. You put that thing on your wrist and hid it from me till you wanted him to see it. Only fools go into that deaf and dumb talk and think their secret. You will understand that you are not to compromise yourself. Behave with dignity. That's all I have to say. With that last word, Grandcourt rose, turned his back to the fire and looked down on her. She was mute. There was no reproach that she dared to fling back at him in return for these insulting admonitions, and the very reason she felt them to be insulting was that their purport went with the most absolute dictate of her pride. What she would least like to incur was the making a fool of herself and being compromised. It was futile and irrelevant to try and explain that Deronda too had only been a monitor, the strongest of all monitors. Grandcourt was contemptuous, not jealous, contemptuously certain of all this objection he cared for. Why could she not rebel and defy him? She longed to do it. But she might as well have tried to defy the texture of her nerves and the palpitation of her heart. Her husband had a ghostly army at his back that could close round her wherever she might turn. She sat in her splendid attire, like a white image of helplessness, and he seemed to gratify himself with looking at her. She could not even make a passionate exclamation, or throw up her arms, as she would have done in her maiden days. The sense of his scorn kept her still. "Shall I ring?" he said, after what seemed to her a long while. She moved her head in assent, and after ringing he went to his dressing room. Certain words were gnawing within her. "See, the wrong you have done me will be your own curse." As he closed the door, the bitter tears rose, and the gnawing words provoked an answer: "Why did you put your fangs into me, and not into him?" It was uttered in a whisper, as the tears came up silently. But she immediately pressed her handkerchief against her eyes, and checked her tendency to sob. The next day, recovered from the shuddering fit of this evening scene, she determined to use the charter which Grandcourt had scornfully given her, and to talk as much as she liked with Deronda. But no opportunities occurred, and any little devices she could imagine for creating them were rejected by her pride, which was now doubly active. Not toward Deronda himself, she was singularly free from alarm lest he should think her openness wanting in dignity. It was part of his power over her that she believed him free from all misunderstanding as to the way in which she appealed to him, or rather, that he should misunderstand her had never entered into her mind. But the last morning came, and still as he had never been able to take up the dropped thread of their talk, and she was without devices. She and Grandcourt were to leave at 3 o'clock. It was too irritating that after a walk in the grounds had been planned in Deronda's hearing, he did not present himself to join in it. Grandcourt was gone with Sir Hugo to King's Topping to see the old manor house. Others of the gentlemen were shooting. She was condemned to go and see the decoy and the waterfowl, and everything else that she least wanted to see, with the ladies, with old Lord Pentreath and his anecdotes, with Mr. Vandernoot and his admiring manners. The irritation became too strong for her. Without premeditation, she took advantage of the winding road to linger a little out of sight, and then set off back to the house, almost running when she was safe from observation. She entered by a side door, and the library was on her left hand. Deronda, she knew, was often there. Why might she not turn in there as well as into any other room in the house? As he had been taken there, expressly to see the illuminated family tree, and other remarkable things, what more natural than that she should like to look in again? The thing most to be feared was that the room would be empty of Deronda, for the door was ajar. She pushed it gently, and looked round it. He was there, writing busily at a distant table, with his back toward the door. In fact, Sir Hugo had asked him to answer some constituents' letters which had become pressing. An enormous log fire, with the scent of Russia from the books, made the great room as warmly odorous as a private chapel in which the censors have been swinging. It seemed too daring to go in too rude to speak and interrupt him. Yet she went in on the noiseless carpet, and stood still for 2 or 3 minutes, till Deronda, having finished a letter, pushed it aside for signature, and threw himself back to consider whether there were anything else for him to do, or whether he could walk out for the chance of meeting the party which included Gwendolyn, when he heard her voice saying, "Mr. Deronda." It was certainly startling. He rose hastily, turned round, and pushed away his chair with a strong expression of surprise. "Am I wrong to come in?" said Gwendolyn. "I thought you were far on your walk," said Deronda. "I turned back," said Gwendolyn. "Do you intend to go out again? I could join you now, if you would allow me." "No, I want to say something, and I can't stay long," said Gwendolyn, speaking quickly in a subdued tone, while she walked forward and rested her arms and muff on the back of the chair he had pushed away from him. I want to tell you that it is really so I can't help feeling remorse for having injured others. That was what I meant when I said that I had done worse than gamble again and pawn the necklace again, something more injurious, as you called it. And I can't alter it. I am punished, but I can't alter it. You said I could do many things. Tell me again. What should you do, what should you feel, if you were in my place?" The hurried directness with which she spoke, the absence of all her little airs, as if she were only concerned to use the time in getting an answer that would guide her, made her appeal unspeakably touching. Deronda said, "Should feel something of what you feel, deep sorrow." "But what would you try to do?" said Gwendolyn, with urgent quickness. "Order my life so as to make any possible amends, and keep away from doing any sort of injury again," said Deronda, catching her sense that the time for speech was brief. "But I can't, I must go on," said Gwendolyn, in a passionate loud whisper. I have thrust out others, I have made my gain out of their loss, tried to make it tried. And I must go on. I can't alter it." It was impossible to answer this instantaneously. Her words had confirmed his conjecture, and the situation of all concerned rose in swift images before him. His feeling for those who had been thrust out sanctioned her remorse. He could not try to nullify it, yet his heart was full of pity for her. But as soon as he could, he answered, taking up her last words, "That is the bitterest of all, to wear the yoke of our own wrongdoing. But if you submitted to that as men submit to maiming or lifelong incurable disease, and made the unalterable wrong a reason for more effort toward a good that may do something to counterbalance the evil, one who has committed irremediable errors may be scourged by that consciousness into a higher course than is common. There are many examples. Feeling what it is to have spoiled one life may well make us long to save other lives from being spoiled." "But you have not wronged anyone, or spoiled their lives," said Gwendolyn, hastily. It is only others who have wronged you." Deronda colored slightly, but said immediately, "Suppose our keen feeling for ourselves might end in giving us a keen feeling for others, if, when we are suffering acutely, we were to consider that others go through the same sharp experience. That is a sort of remorse before commission. Can't you understand that?" "I think I do now," said Gwendolyn. "But you were right, I am selfish. I have never thought much of anyone's feelings, except my mother's. I have not been fond of people. But what can I do?" She went on, more quickly. I must get up in the morning and do what everyone else does. It is all like a dance set beforehand. I seem to see all that can be, and I am tired and sick of it. And the world is all confusion to me." She made a gesture of disgust. "Why, you say I am ignorant. But what is the good of trying to know more, unless life were worth more? This good, said Deronda promptly, with a touch of indignant severity, which he was inclined to encourage as his own safeguard. Life would be worth more to you. Some real knowledge would give you an interest in the world beyond the small drama of personal desires. It is the curse of your life, forgive me of so many lives, that all passion is spent in that narrow round, for want of ideas and sympathies to make a larger home for it. Is there any single occupation of mind that you care about with passionate delight, or even independent interest? Deronda paused, but Gwendolyn, looking startled and thrilled, as by an electric shock, said nothing, and he went on more insistently, I take what you said of music for a small example. It answers for all larger things. You will not cultivate it for the sake of a private joy in it. What sort of earth or heaven would hold any spiritual wealth in it for souls pauperized by inaction? If one firmament has no stimulus for our attention and awe, I don't see how four would have it. We should stamp every possible world with the flatness of our own inanity, which is necessarily impious, without faith or fellowship. The refuge you are needing from personal trouble is the higher, the religious life, which holds an enthusiasm for something more than our own appetites and vanities. The few may find themselves in it simply by an elevation of feeling, but for us who have to struggle for our wisdom, the higher life must be a region in which the affections are clad with knowledge. The half-indignant remonstrance that vibrated in Deronda's voice came, as often happens, from the habit of inward argument with himself, rather than from severity toward Gwendolyn. But it had a more beneficial effect on her than any soothings. Nothing is feebler than the indolent rebellion of complaint, and to be roused into self-judgment is comparative activity. For the moment she felt like a shaken child shaken out of its wailing into awe, and she said humbly, I will try. I will think. They both stood silent for a minute, as if some third presence had arrested them, for Deronda too, was under that sense of pressure which is apt to come when our own winged words seem to be hovering around us. Till Gwendolyn began again, you said affection was the best thing, and I have hardly any none about me. If I could, I would have Mama, but that is impossible. Things have changed to me so in such a short time. What I used not to like I long for now. I think I am almost getting fond of the old things now they are gone. Her lip trembled. Take the present suffering as a painful letting in of light, said Deronda, more gently. Why you are conscious of more beyond the round of your own inclinations, you know more of the way in which your life presses on others, and their life on yours. I don't think you could have escaped the painful process in some form or other. But it is a very cruel form, said Gwendolyn, beating her foot on the ground with returning agitation. I am frightened at everything. I am frightened at myself. When my blood is fired I can do daring things, take any leap. But that makes me frightened at myself. She was looking at nothing outside her, but her eyes were directed toward the window, away from Deronda, who, with quick comprehension said, turn your fear into a safeguard. Keep your dread fixed on the idea of increasing, that remorse which is so bitter to you. Fixed meditation may do a great deal toward defining our longing or dread. We are not always in a state of strong emotion, and when we are calm we can use our memories, and gradually change the bias of our fear, as we do our tastes. Take your fear. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.